We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
As we proceed through Daniel, we notice that there's a certain repetitiveness about the message. Tonight again we see a king who is in trouble. Great one who is about to be cut down. And again we see Daniel is the only one in the land who knows how to interpret the signs and the message. We see him again confronting the enchanters. We see again idolatry in the land. We again have the message of God being the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the only ruler of princes. We again see the principle of pride going before the fall. Now, it doesn't matter that we see it again and again, because firstly, God inspired it to be written down for us several times and for the events to happen. And secondly, because we're basically slow learners. And thirdly, because it's a very important message to learn. Who is actually in control of my life is a fundamental question for me to answer. And most of us breeze along in life without even thinking of the question, let alone finding the answer. And so one of the good things of the book of Daniel is it keeps on asking you the same question as to whether you still are trying to be king or whether you have recognised that there is a king over and above your competence, rule, power and might. It keeps raising that same question. However, now in Daniel, we do see some developments. We can now, of course, start to compare the kings. Not only is it Nebuchadnezzar, but we have Belshazzar, and right at the end of this week's reading, we have Darius the Mede, and we'll be able to look at him next week. And each of these kings is put into the conflict situation and handles it slightly differently, and each of them presents to us a different character, a different personality, a different facet of the character that is yours and mine. Of all the people in the Bible, one of the most unattractive that you have is Belshazzar. I don't think there is a good thing said about him. There is much said that is bad. In fact, he's just straight out dreadful. I think the snake in the garden gets worse press. But I'm hard-pressed to think of anybody else who does as badly as Belshazzar. I've never met anybody who's named their children after him. For that matter, I haven't met anyone who's named their children after Nebuchadnezzar either. But you wouldn't after Belshazzar if you knew the story. Belshazzar Jensen would be a mouthful, to put it mildly. However, before we look at that message again, I want to take a few moments to talk about the historical reliability of this part of the Bible. Only for a few moments, and only brief, but briefly for a couple of reasons. Because for many of us, the reading of a book about the ancient world gives us the vague feeling that we've moved into fairyland. Most of us are relatively uneducated about the ancient world. We knew there were Egyptians and Romans and Greeks, and it was the Egyptians that built the pyramids. And so that got us through the Department of Education examinations. And we really haven't got much more than that. So that when you hear about a man with the unlikely name of Belshazzar back in the land of Babylon, well, it's all once upon a time back in the land when of Shinar, and in the city of Babylon, there once lived a wicked king called Belshazzar, and you're expecting Walt Disney to produce it. And therefore, it's helpful for us to look back every now and then at what we know from outside the Bible, as well as from inside the Bible, about the events that took place then, and to perceive these people as real people in a real land, in a real context, that we know of fighting the fights that are described here and losing the battles that we see described here. But there is a second reason I want to spend a few moments talking about it tonight, and that is
that this is one of the parts of the Bible that is under challenge and question about its historical reliability. There are certain difficulties that people raise about the book of Daniel, and especially about the men Belshazzar and Darius the Mede. And I want to raise those for you because I think it's much better that you have me raise them for you than you find out someday somewhere else by a person who doesn't believe the Bible at all and who is using it to beat Christians over the head with. They are the people who really do give us a great problem and difficulty because you say, well, I heard a series of sermons on Daniel, but nobody mentioned to me there was any historical difficulty about it. I thought that was all clear-cut and perfectly straightforward. It was the Bible. It must be true. But now you're pointing out to me facts that nobody ever mentioned to me. So that you won't get that let-down feeling 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the track, let me show you what the problems are, or some of the little bit of the problems, so that you can understand what the argumentations are about, and so that you might be prepared for the attacks of the evil one. Firstly, a word or two about Belshazzar. The last king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire of Babylon was a man called Nabonidus. Nabonidus, M-A-N-N-N-A-B-O-N-I-D-U-S, Nabonidus. He was well known to the ancient world, and the historians speak of him, and the historians of the ancient, that is the ancient historians as well as modern, will speak of him as that last king. He fought many battles, ruled for some 10-15 years, and was well known to be the final king, beaten by Cyrus the Persian at the fall of the Babylonian Empire. So who was Belshazzar? That was a problem for historians at a different period than our present time, because all the evidence that they had at their disposal was that Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. And Belshazzar wasn't referred to until we, in the last 120 years or so, found more information about the rule of Nabonidus. For the last 10 years of his rule, he wandered in what we call Palestine. And in that period, went on this long extended journey, which was at first a militaristic campaign, but seemed to be extended beyond just fighting battles. Great confusion broke out within the Babylonian community itself. Nabonidus was a bit of a religious adventurer. He moved away from the Chaldean religion that ruled the Neo-Babylonian Empire's theological understanding. He went into all kinds of novelties, and he brought great disquiet and disharmony within the Babylonian community, which he tried to rule from a couple of thousand miles away. The basic method he used was by leaving his son, who was apparently a fairly weak-willed young man, in control of the city during his extended stay in Palestine. And his son's name was, of course, Belshazzar. Belshazzar, for 10 years then, was the co-regent of the last king of Babylon, namely Nabonidus. That is, the Bible, written by people and observed by this man Daniel in this case, who were living in Babylon, the Bible records that the last king, the man who was actually in control when the Persians moved in and destroyed, was the man Belshazzar, which, if you were living in Babylon at the time, was of course accurate, for that was the one who was there. His father did get back to Babylon before the fall, but having seen the writing on the wall in a different sense than Belshazzar, he left the city in the very incapable hands of his son and was defeated in warfare elsewhere shortly afterwards. Little wonder the poor man had a party and got drunk, because the place was already fairly much under siege, not technically under siege, but the fighting was already going badly for the Babylonians, and his father had taken the army out of the city. Little wonder the city fell so quickly that very night, seeing the great general had gone, leaving his drunken son in charge. It's one of the peculiar accuracies of the Old Testament that such an unimportant character as Belshazzar was continued to be recorded in the accounts, even when his very existence from all other sources had seemed to fade out of knowledge. R.H. Pfeiffer, who was a very radical critic of the earlier part of his century, was forced to admit that it will be never known how the author of Daniel knew that Belshazzar was the functioning king when Babylon fell. Pfeiffer says that, of course, because he didn't believe that Daniel lived in the 6th century and wrote anything or saw any visions. He thought this was a 2nd century work, and he couldn't work out how someone in the 2nd century would ever knew that Belshazzar existed, seeing there's no record in the 2nd century that Belshazzar did. Darius the Mede is mentioned in the last verse of the chapter. And Darius the Mede is not known to us in any other record. The only reference to this man that we have in existence today is in the book of Daniel. So, who was this Darius the Mede, and how does that fit in with history? There are three answers to those questions. One is to say that the book of Daniel is inaccurate. The writer got it wrong. The conqueror of Babylon was not Darius, but Cyrus. Our author goofed because he wasn't there and he didn't know. Secondly, you could say, our knowledge of what happened then was incomplete. Darius the Mede did come in, did conquer, and then handed over to Cyrus the king of Persia. Our knowledge is incomplete, it's just that nobody else records that little event except for this book. And so this book has it right, although we just don't have it anywhere else. There's a possibility, isn't it? The third alternative is that we don't understand this book properly. That what it's saying about Darius the Mede, we haven't quite understood yet. Now, which of those alternatives to follow? Well, of course, if you're an unbeliever in the Bible, the first one is the most attractive. But having just told you about Belshazzar, it should warn you not to jump to that conclusion too quickly, shouldn't it? For there was a day and there was an age, it would have been easy to say, well, Belshazzar, we don't know anything about Belshazzar now, but Nabonidus was the last king. See, the book's got it wrong. Throw this book away. It doesn't know anything about the ancient world. When we come to greater complete knowledge of the ancient world, we find out the book had it better than we did. The details were there. And so the first, while it's the answer of the unbeliever that the book's got it wrong, is an answer of also a silly person because he thinks he knows everything. Just because Darius the Mede isn't referred to anywhere else doesn't mean that Darius the Mede didn't live and didn't do exactly what this book says. But there is a bit more of a problem here because we know that Cyrus, the king of Persia, was the conqueror of Babylon. So how do you fit Darius in? Well, it may be our knowledge of the conquest is incomplete. And you'll find some people argue that Darius the Mede is the name of either the governor or the general who conquered Babylon in Cyrus's name. That is, we know that Cyrus himself did not actually walk into the city in conquest, but his general did, and he handed it over to Cyrus's governor for a month or so before Cyrus actually took up control. The two men have the delightful names of Gubaru and Ugbaru. I don't know if that's how you pronounce them because I've never actually had lessons in Persian. If you like writing down names, G-U-B-A-R-U and U-G-B-A-R-U, as in the Australian Railway Union. Now, either of these men, it is argued, could actually be Darius the Mede because the Persians had just previously conquered the Medes, or rather joined in a great alliance with the Medes. And it could be that some of the prominent, some of the prominent people of Cyrus's reign did come from a Median background. In fact, Cyrus himself came from a Mead family. And so it could be that that is what is being referred to here, and the man had another name that we didn't know about. Could be. You'll find the New Bible Dictionary article on Daniel argues that way, written by a man called J.C. Whitcomb. He wrote a long book on the subject as well. However, the third alternative is the one that appeals to me as more likely, and that is that we don't understand the book of Daniel properly. Darius the Mede may in fact be another name for Cyrus the Persian. This is the argument that has been put forward by great Assyriologist D.J. Wiseman, who writes the article on Darius in the New Bible Dictionary again, but he has written the argument up in several books, which you won't be pursuing, so I won't tell you about. But you see it in verse 28 of chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 28, where it says, "So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian." But it could equally be translated down in the footnote of the New International Version, "So Daniel prospered through the reign of Darius, that is, the reign of Cyrus the Persian." The word can equally be translated "and," as if they're two different people, or "that is," as if it is in fact the one and the same person. And we know that at the time at which Babylon was conquered, Cyrus, whose life we know very well, was around 60 years of age. And you'll see at the end of chapter 5, verse 31, that when Darius the Mede conquered Babylon, he was 62. So that if they are two separate men, they're of much the same age. But if they're the same man, well then that's what you would expect. He was around 60. And we also know that Cyrus came from a Median background, and that helped in his taking over of the Median kingdom. And so he may indeed enjoy a Median title Darius and a Persian title Cyrus. So that it could be the same person. But we don't know. And if someone should say to you, "But there's no reference to people like Darius the Mede anywhere else in ancient literature," they're absolutely true. That in itself does not prove that what we have before us here, of course, is inaccurate. In fact, what it appoints to me is the exact reverse, the actual accuracy of what has taken place. For the character of history is to have loose and ragged edges to the account, is not to have all the details tied up. That is the character of fiction. It's fiction writers who like to give everything its proper place and exact arrangement. That's fiction writing. History is not like that because life's not like that. Memories are not like that. It's much more likely in history to have bits and pieces just hanging a little bit loose. I went and saw a movie the other night, The Witness. And Harrison Ford finally arriving at the stage of an A-grade movie, to his great disappointment, I'm sure you'll know, he would hear that I think it's a B-grade movie at the best. But the story is as old as the hills. If you watch the television for 20-odd years, you'll be... Well, it comes into a point at one stage in the story where he looks into a corn bin there, and I won't give the whole story away, you can still go and see the movie, but he comes into this corn bin, and as he comes in, being an inveterate television watcher, I said to myself, that is going to come in later in the story. That is going to be significant. In fact, I could even work out what's going to happen, but I won't tell you that bit. Because nobody would write that bit into the story if they weren't going to use it later on. And, sure enough, later on, it came into the story. It was an irrelevant piece of thing to do. It's just the kind of thing that was set up by a fiction writer because he needed it. Because that's the character of fiction. It's all neat and tidy like that. There's no loose ends hanging around. But history is not like that at all. Especially certain climatic, chaotic moments in history. Here is a sample test to really strain your historical knowledge. Who was the man in control of Germany when Berlin fell in the Second World War? Goebbels? Well, who was in control a month before? Don't even know that. I'll give you 6 months before who was in control. You're all there, aren't we now? 6 months before Berlin fell, we all know Adolf Hitler's in control. A month before, Adolf Hitler in control. But the week before? Oh, it's a bit hard to remember now, isn't it? I mean, that's very hard. That's like Saigon. We can all tell you who was the president of South Vietnam
you know, the month or so beforehand, but the actual, when Saigon fell, those couple of nights, before, who was in control then? Because the president had fled. And in the week after it fell, who was in control? I was watching a documentary on it the other day, and in the 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, no one knew who was in control. Chaos was the state. Afterwards, of course, well, it all comes to normality and you know again who's in control. We are talking about the night the city fell. The king had fled with the army. The Persian armies have come in and take control. A month or so later, Cyrus is there. But during the actual nights as to the last Babylonian and the first Persian, that's exactly the state at which you would expect chaotic information. That's what you get. Because the Bible is dealing with real people and real events and memories and history as history is. Not necessarily inaccurate, but not necessarily able to be tied down at every point. Because that's the way it is, the way life is. But the realism goes beyond that because the people you're dealing with are such real people. The Bible portrays for us a man who could live in the 20th century in this Belshazzar. You've met many of them, actually. Full of mistakes. There are not many good points in this one. Look at them as we rattle through them fairly quickly. Idolatry. That's what he's practicing. The key verse is the verse 23. It captures more of the ideas than any of the other ones, I think, in the chapter. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. You knew all about Nebuchadnezzar, and you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You've had the goblets from the temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver, of gold, bronze, iron, wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, but you did not honour the God who holds you in his hand, who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Idolatry was part of his lifestyle. Drinking and praising the gods of wood and silver. Stupid idolatry, because these gods cannot see, they cannot hear, and you're singing their praises. Nebuchadnezzar was much the same with his statue. Idolatry is always an insult to God. Idolatry is always an insult to man's intelligence. And yet idolatry is the normal practice of religion, isn't it? And religious bric-a-brac is big business. Silver, gold, pendants and charms, and you can make a lot of money out of it. A lot of people are making a lot of money out of it all over the world. Insult to man's intelligence and insult to God notwithstanding. And caught up in idolatry, as so often is the case, is the whole practice of sorcery, the paranormal he looks to, the enchanters, the astrologers, the diviners of verse 7. Surely he would know of Daniel, but no. A society that is riddled with the superstitious occult practices. At best, these things are nonsense. At worst, they are the involvement with the demonic powers. There's the option. And still today, in every newspaper, there are astrology columns. And there are advertisements in the classifieds for the different mediums you can go to, who will look at anything from the stars to the entrails of animals, from the rats that run across the floor to the palms or to the emptiness of your head, to find out what the future should or will happen for you and control it and answer all the secret dreams and mysteries of the universe. At best, you're being ripped off because it's crass nonsense. At worst, they are tampering with what they do not know and understand, but which will control them. We're not certain of the blood alcohol level of Belshazzar, but the party was described in terms of a courtly booze-up. A man whose judgment and sense was lost in grog. Faced with the inevitable, he had a party. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And reduced himself, as people still do, to being something less than themselves by the stupefying influence of alcohol.
2:30 in the morning.
Thanks to the wonders of digital clocks, 2:29. An explosion outside our place last night. Another alcoholic took themselves out on a telegraph pole.
Dreadful business, you say. Can't control themselves, can't control the car they're driving. They skid helplessly in a terrible mess. A mess to not only their life, of course, but the life of the families they come from. The inconvenience and the mass cost to our community, as you see, police and fire and ambulance and rescue squads and electricity commission all pouring out as to fix up the mess and clean up the... And Daniel's speech makes clear that this foolish man's pride lies at so much of what takes place. The story of Nebuchadnezzar must have been well known in his family. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, was his great-grandfather, not his direct father. The story of this great king, the builder of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, who had been reduced to an animal for 7 years, as we saw last week. Of course, that happened a long time ago, and people's memories are so very short, aren't they? 30 years, or whatever it may have been, was just too long, although he should have known. He did know. Verse 22, after being reminded of the story of Nebuchadnezzar, you do know all this, Belshazzar, but yet you still live in the pride and arrogance of the people of power. Your life and your ways are in God's hands, but you think you run your own life and your own affairs, even in the face of an empire that is about to crush you. You still think that you can run it all yourself. The essence of pride, to imagine that you can live without God, to act as if God is not there, to exist as if you are the God of your own life. That's what pride is ultimately all about. And it's so common today in our society. For people do not stop and thank God for food and life and beauty and pleasure, but they think it's theirs by right. They think they have the power to own it, to buy it, to consume it, to use it, to waste it, for it's their life. And basically, Belshazzar was a stupid man, as so many Australians are stupid. Because you can see in verse 22, as Daniel is able to point out to him, he knew God was there, and yet he lived as if God was not there. Now there is real stupidity, isn't it? To know the truth and to live as if it is not the truth. To ignore the truth that you know is classic stupidity. I'm always tickled a little bit by the stupidity of verse 29 as well, where he gives a third of his kingdom to Daniel. It always seems to be peculiarly stupid, this one, because he does that because Daniel told him the truth. So he gives him a third of the kingdom. But the truth that Daniel told him is that the kingdom is just about to be taken away from him. So what's he give him? A third of a kingdom that's just about to be taken away. Can never quite work that out, really. I can see why Daniel didn't want it. One, it wasn't worth having. And two, if you were there with the invading kingdoms, would you like to be the bloke dressed up in purple? Gold chain placed around his neck. Someone actually at Friday night raised for me an interesting question as to why was he made the third highest in the kingdom? Why not made the second highest in the kingdom? Could it be that even here we have a hint at the fact that our author knows, or Belshazzar knew, that the first highest in the kingdom wasn't Belshazzar, was actually Nabonidus? I don't know if that's the case or not. And I really haven't had the time to look back through the books to see what they make of that. That's an interesting suggestion nonetheless, isn't it? It's worth inquiring further. But here is the great gift of a stupid man. If the story is true that Daniel's telling you, there's no point giving him a third of anything. So we have a drunken, superstitious, idolatrous, proud fool. Not much going for him, is there? But this man has one peculiar talent. One peculiar unpleasantry of this proud potentate is sacrilege. For he takes the vessels of God's temple and uses them for his own drunken revelry, and uses them for the worship of idols. It's this arrogant blasphemy which is the rock bottom of the barrel, which brings to us a new low in degeneracy. Verse 23, again, you see the barb of it, don't you? You know all about the God of heaven, the Lord who rules, and you have taken the goblets from his temple to have your bacchanalian feast. He knew God, but he openly, publicly, willfully flaunted his total disrespect for God. The vessels, of course, in themselves were nothing. But it was the provided the opportunity for an express expression of his attitude to the Almighty. But Belshazzar is not alone. His story is not told to us for academic interest, but a piece of anecdotal trivia from the ancient world, for when the ancient historians produced their ancient historians' trivial pursuit. It's all written as a warning for us. The scriptures teach us in the New Testament, it's all written as a warning for us. The scriptures teach us in the New Testament, passages like Romans 15 and verse 4, that these things are written for us that we might know how to live. 2 Timothy 3:16-17, again the same. Written for our learning, to correct us, to challenge us, to teach us, to direct us. And so Belshazzar's mistakes must stand out for us as very clear warnings not to follow in his path. It's interesting how many of them actually occur in Romans chapter 1, in the second half of that chapter, the great chapter in which Paul spells out the character of sinfulness. It's almost as if Belshazzar is a walking example of sinfulness, for he does so many of the things that are listed there in Romans 1. Idolatry is part of that Romans 1 picture of sinfulness. Men who reject God do not move into no God, they move into the worship of other things. We will always worship things. You can worship the God who is there, or you can worship the mighty dollar, or you can worship a little statue, but you'll worship something. You can worship your children or your cattle or your dog, but you'll worship something. We always give our lives to something, and the stupidity of idolatry is always there, because we're in idolatry always giving your life to something that's less than yourself, something that never looks after you, something that you've got to look after. You've got to keep your little statue polished, just like your motor car, just like your career or your house or your boat. You've got to look after the things that you're worshipping. They're always less than you that you are worshipping, which is a great nonsense. Unless your God is greater than you, your worship of your God is stupid. The God who is greater than you is the God of heaven. And part of the religion that people turn to so often is the sorcery, the powers, the principalities, the secret knowledges, the secrets of the empire, of the universe, of the force, or whatever it may be, the visions, the experiences, the capacity to look beyond into the realm of the quest for knowledge that can be seen in any bookshop now, the learned and the popular, the myriads of books on how to tap in to the supernaturalistic forces that are available. And we have friends here who can well give you testimony of the disasters that came upon their lives when they did tap into it. The seances, the Ouija boards, and all the rest. The dreadful shock that came to them when it stopped being the party game and things started to happen. And if it hasn't happened to you, it's most likely happened to friends that you know of. The widespread nature of the occult in our community is quite surprising, for we make such light of it publicly while practicing it so privately. But it's never to be part of the Christian life, for we are dealing with God. And the way of debilitating stupidity, of falling prey to the drink. Belshazzar, was a genuine Australian in that regard. The senseless glamorisation of it in our culture is an appalling state to live in. Let me read to you from Proverbs chapter 23, verse 29. Proverbs 23. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaints? Who has needless bruises and who has bloodshot eyes? Those who linger over wine, who go to sample bowls of mixed wine. Do not gaze at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights, your mind imagine confusing things, and you'll be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying atop of the rigging. They hit me, you will say, but I'm not hurt. They beat me, but I don't feel it. When will I wake up so I can find another drink? Do not envy wicked men. Do not desire their company. The Bible teaches that God made wine to make glad the heart of man, that alcohol, like all the things of this earth, are part of God's good creation for us to enjoy and use. For the capacity of sinfulness is not to use but to abuse. And the capacity for abuse in this area is a massive national scandal which we must grasp hold of. Lo and behold, in Belgium the other night, daytime theirs, somebody suggested afterwards that one of the problems was an excessive consumption of alcohol. They say it every time after every football disaster. But we still sell it just outside the ground, let them carry it in, and we glamorise it. And so you're not really a hero in any of the movies until you can quaff some down. Statistical surveys of the amount of drinking that is done and during movies is fascinating to read. For they drink alcohol more than they do almost any other activity on a movie screen. Always doing it. Extraordinary, because it's part of the image of being a real man, to hold your booze. It's part of a lifestyle which is destroying the very stuff of our society and the lives of people. But we will not speak out against it for fear of being classified as wowsers. And we will not act against it. It was interesting to see that just as the Christians gave up attacking smoking, the non-Christians started. Now, it's fashionable to criticise smoking, though it does no more damage than drink. In fact, I would argue in a debate anyway, although it's one of those debates you couldn't prove, it does far less damage than alcohol. If my family members smoke, then I smell. if my family members drink to excess, then I suffer more than smell. Drunkenness is not to be part of the Christian lifestyle. It's part of the foolishness of the Belshazzars. Do not be led astray there. Or pride, to think of my life without God, lies at the heart of what Paul says is sin in Romans 1:18 following. I know God is there, but I don't want God to run my life. I don't want God to be... I want to be God. I don't want someone else to tell me what to do, even if he's got the right to. I want to do my thing. I mightn't be much, but I'm all I've got. But I haven't got me. I don't own me. I don't run me. I cannot live a moment. Not a moment. Unless God keeps me alive. Cannot happen. Last Sunday, a dear friend, in the sense of a Christian brother, not in the sense of someone close to me, I didn't have the opportunity much of knowing, but a Christian brother who was joining our church on Friday nights in the Friday night churches, died. He'd heard the sermon that you heard last Sunday. You know about the rich fool, build bigger houses, and then God says, this night your soul is required of you. And you sit there thinking, yeah, well, that happens to other people. But one of the people I said it to last Friday night, it happened to him. Just 2 days after he heard it. But you still think, yeah, but that happens to other people, doesn't it? It always happens to other people until it's too late for you. Praise God, a man of Christian testimony and witness, for whom it wasn't a matter of you fool, but the call of his Lord to come home. This pride that we have that says, it's my life. It's like, and Belshazzar's like, a hit parade song that I figured none of you would know, but I've now found out that you nearly all know it, which confuses me no end, because I thought I was just a teeny bopper when it was on the radio. And so therefore you must all be older than I think you are. Where some singer, female, who only could get it through the nasal cavities, used to scream, and I can't remember her name, of course, Miss Nasal Cavities, used to scream down over and over again, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to. Die if I want to. My party. You see, there's Belshazzar. It's mine. And you tell me whether I can or can't cry. It's my life. I'm going to do with it what I want. I'm fundamentally weak about that kind of pride, isn't there? It's pride and stupidity. The ultimate stupidity of knowing God, but not honouring him as God, not serving him as God, not worshipping him as God, not thanking him as God, but ignoring him as if he's not there. Oh, when I'm in the surf and I get really thrown around and dragged out and there's a rip, well, I say, please, God, do something now. Oh, yeah, when the car starts spinning around and there's a blowout and I'm getting a bit scared, then I say, well, Lord, get me out of this and I might find out about you. Oh, yeah, there are little times of queasy terror that, yeah, I'll even run up a quick urgent prayer just on the off chance that he's there, because I know he is and maybe he could do something for me. Oh, yeah, but at any other time, he's just as if he's not. John Chapman's marvellous book, A Fresh Start, which is available up here on the bookshop, I'm sure, brings it out beautifully. He says, how do you like friends to treat you? Do you like people who just ring you up when they need you and ignore you at any other time? Well, what makes you think that God's so pleased about the way you're treating him? Running up those urgent little requests, if not demands, like a spoilt brat when the party's not turning out exactly to your fancy, but in any other time through the life, just pretending he's not there, just acting as if you are God and he is a nothing. There is the stupidity, the pride of a society built, as ours is built, on false worship, idolatry and sorcery and drunkenness and hopelessness. And ultimately, there's nowhere else to go but ultimately to shake your fist at God in the sacrilege. What else can I do to show my hatred and disdain and scorn? Not only do all manner of ungodly things, but I use my mind, as it comes to the end of Romans 1, to actually imagine, to invent up, to think up more ways of denying him, of doing evil, of doing that which is repulsive to him. The ultimate degeneracy of the fertile, sinful imagination, the X-rated video movies, where people have seemingly put their mind to think of what else can we do that is completely and utterly horrific, blood-curdling, immoral, degenerate, perverted, twisted, because that'll be fun. That will make money, because people love to look at it. The God who has created beauty, the God who has created enjoyment, the God who has created a good world for us to have, but when you reject God, you ultimately head down the track where you cannot like anything God creates and can only really enjoy that which is a total denial of him. It was only a year or two ago, of course, when that scandal broke out, of which some of our members of our congregation knew about, of the video movies that had been made and were selling up at the cross here, of murders, real murders. Some of them had been performed in order to make the video. You see the level that we reach. The level of the total denial of God. You see where it goes. And you have to scream out sometimes, somewhere, how far do you have to go before you wake up? How far down in the bog do you have to get before you can actually start to see that there is no way turning back on God and rejecting him like that? That things are wrong. Not just socially unacceptable, not just something I haven't been yet socialised for, but fundamentally that cannot be right. How far do you have to go in taking the vessels of the temple of God and worshipping the idols whom he detests? For Christian friends at this point, can I remind you of something else? That's off the track of what I'm saying here. But a little ponder for you later on. So if you just get your pens working for a moment and write down 1 Corinthians 6 and 2 Corinthians 6. 1 Corinthians 6 and 2 Corinthians 6 and 1 Thessalonians 4. I won't give you the verse numbers because I want you to read the whole chapters because it'll do you good. 1 Thessalonians 4, 2 Corinthians 6, 1 Corinthians 6, 1 Thessalonians 4. Because in the New Testament, you see, we are the temple of the Holy Spirit. We are the vessels of God's new temple. And Paul argues in 1 Corinthians 6 that as the vessels of God's new temple, we are not to be united into sexual immorality. For our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. He is not in that talking about the fact that we should go jogging every morning and keep it healthy. If you want to do that, you do that. But that's not what the passage is about. He's saying being the temples of the Holy Spirit, we are to be living in purity, not in sexual immorality. For it is sacrilegious to take the temple, the vessels of the temple of the God and use them for sin. And we are those vessels now, and are to be kept pure. The same comes in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, there about not being unequally yoked. Many take referring to marriage, which I'm sure is a fair extension of its meaning, although fundamentally it's got to do with being in association with false teachers and false apostles. For the temple of God, which is what we are, has nothing in common with the temple of the evil spirits, which is where the false apostles are coming from. And therefore you must come out and be clean. I'm
sure that is appropriately extended to marriage.
And again, 1 Corinthians chapter 4 speaks about us as being called to be holy by God's Holy Spirit that has been given to us, and therefore to know how to enter into marriage in holiness and not like the pagans. There may be other passages that refer to us in those terms, such as in 1 Timothy on vessels used for pure purposes.
That is, if you take the New Testament understanding of what the temple of God now is, that is, God's people are filled with his Spirit, then the sacrilege that Belshazzar did to the vessels is like the sacrilege we do when we take ourselves into such immorality. It is utterly inconsistent and sacrilegious.
The last note you'll see on our outline, God is not mocked, comes out of Galatians chapter 6. Paul, writing to Christians in Turkey there, to encourage them to keep on doing what is right and not getting tired, uses the image of sowing and reaping, because there's always a gap between the two. And during the gap, you get tired of waiting. And he's saying, what you sow, you will reap. You sow for the Spirit or you sow to evil. In due time, you'll reap. So don't get weary in the waiting. And he says that because he says God won't be mocked. He won't be mocked. There are many times at which we do that which is wrong and evil, and persist and continue in it, and are not caught out. And so we think we're getting away with it. But friend, God will not be mocked. What you sow, you will, under God, one day reap. That is the way it is with God. It is like, as many of the students come to facing at the moment, examinations. They're just about to be examined in the future about their past, for what they haven't done in the last little while will now be made manifest, and what they have done will also be made manifest. Your past is about to catch up with you. However, there is a difference, because with God there is something that there isn't with examiners. There is forgiveness. There is the forgiveness that he has won in taking that examination upon himself, in taking the condemnation and failure upon himself in the death of Jesus on our behalf. God will not be mocked. So that if we continue in our ways of idolatrous sorcery, of drunkenness and pride and arrogance, in the stupidity of sacrilege, if we keep going that way, then we will be called to account for it as surely as Belshazzar was. But yet, as Jesus has died for we stupid, proud, sinful, wicked people, we have time and opportunity yet now, even in this last time, we have opportunity to turn back and be forgiven. That our past will not catch up with us, because it has caught up with Jesus on our behalf. So there is a marvellous difference. But you know the crazy thing about sacrilegious people, stupid people? Even when they hear about what Jesus has done for them, even when they hear that although God will not be mocked and they are going to be punished for all that they've done, and yet they know there's a way out of their dilemma, they'll say, it's my party. I'll cry if I want to.
I'll die if I want to. Make sure that you free yourself from the Belshazzar syndrome. Turn back while the day is still day, lest you, like the fool in Jesus' parable, are called to give account tonight. Let's pray. Our Father in heaven, we thank you. Praise you for the warning that is recorded for us in the events of this man. Thank you for your word, which records for us so accurately the events of the past, the events of your dealings with mankind. Please, Lord, be with those amongst us who still are continuing to know you as God and yet not live with you as God. Who are continuing because of their own desires to live their own life, to live willfully in opposition to you. Send your Spirit upon us, Father, that you might free us from the stupidity of it all, from the glamorization of that which is degenerate, perverted, unhealthy, antisocial, self-centered, and stupid. Free us, Father, to know the forgiveness that you have won in Jesus, to be able to come back into relationship with you as our God. And Father, for those of us who have come that way and who know you as our Father, help us. Help us to take the warnings that are here. Help us as your vessels, as your temple, to keep ourselves free from idolatry.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.